Well, hello there, and welcome to the Root Cause Medicine Podcast. I'm your host for today, Dr. Kate Kresge, joined by Dr. Mamina Taregano. She's a board-certified dermatologist and dermatopathologist, and she's here today to talk with us about one of our most highly requested topics on the Root Cause Medicine Podcast ever, hair loss and hair shedding. Now, hair loss and hair shedding can feel deeply personal, and they can often occur during times of high stress or hormonal change. But that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. In fact, there are things we should be doing when a patient shows up after a stressful or hormonally charged period with new onset hair loss or shedding. Dr. Mamina takes us through her protocol, the things she looks at from a root cause workup perspective, including thyroid hormones, sex hormones, inflammation, nutrient deficiencies, and the treatment approaches she uses from her integrative toolkit to help patients get the most benefit and to get the best chances of regrowing hair, even during a stressful period in their life. If you've been searching for the best ways to help your patients address hair loss, this is an episode for you. Let's dive in. Before we get started though, I've got a special question for the practitioners in the audience. Practitioners, what if your supplement dispensing, patient education, and treatment planning all lived in one powerful platform built for whole person care? And what if that platform was free for both you and your patients while saving you hours each week on treatment planning and follow-up? Well, meet FullScript, the comprehensive care delivery platform designed to reduce administrative burden and enhance clinical impact. From automated refills and lab ordering with interpretation, to evidence-based protocols and built-in adherence support, FullScript integrates the tools you need to streamline care and stay focused on what matters most, your patients. In a recent survey, 74% of providers reported saving up to 3 hours per week using FullScript to create their treatment plans. Are you ready to work smarter and elevate your practice? Visit FullScript.com to get started today. Dr. Mamina Taregano, welcome to the Root Cause Medicine Podcast.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So you are a triple board certified dermatologist, an internist, a dermatopathologist. I am really curious how you arrived at your integrative approach to these issues.
Yeah, it's interesting. Before I went to medical school, I was so interested in alternative forms of healing. My mom, who's Japanese, exposed me to a lot of interesting healing modalities. She's not a physician or anything in the healthcare field. Whenever we were sick, she would always have random remedies that were not conventional at all. So my mind was already very open to it. Like if we were constipated, she would massage a certain part on my index finger. And then when I was in college, I became really interested in nutrition. And I was like, you know what? And just the whole naturopathic medical world was really intriguing to me. And I was considering going to naturopathic medical school. I also was really inspired by Dr. Andrew Weil. He is a medical doctor with a focus in integrative medicine. And I was like, you know what? I think if I go to medical school, I have options to practice integrative medicine. I have a lot of options if I go down the conventional MD route. And so I decided to do that. My plan was to go into primary care and do integrative medicine. But when I did my internal medicine rotation, there was a subspecialty called rheumatology, which focuses on autoimmune diseases. And there are a lot of skin issues that are autoimmune related, a lot of overlap there. And I was really drawn to these patients with lupus and scleroderma who had these really debilitating skin findings. And I had such empathy towards these patients. And I was like, you know what, maybe I should look into dermatology just to see what's going on. And dermatology, I think, is an amazing specialty because it covers so many things: adults, pediatrics, there's complex medical stuff, there's fun cosmetic stuff, there's a little bit of surgery, there's pathology. So there's a subspecialty, dermatopathology, that I specialize in. And I loved pathology in medical school, but I was like, I don't want to sit in a microscope all day in a basement. I want to treat patients. But when I was doing my derm residency, I fell in love with the dermatopathology part, which is why I pursued that specialty. But the overall theme that I really love about dermatology is that I think your skin can tell so much about what's going on internally. It's like a window to what's going on. And I think it's on theme with taking a really integrative approach, really treating the whole body and also integrating other aspects of medicine. As I've practiced medicine more and more, I have come to realize that there are so many limitations with the conventional medical practice. Don't get me wrong, I am so thankful for everything, all the medical breakthroughs and all the prescription medicines that we have. And it's helped so many people, but I've also seen some limitations and realizing that integrating other aspects, whether it's looking at lifestyle, nutrition, and diet, and looking at that patient from that more holistic lens. And when you treat the whole body, that is going to help their skin too.
That's so true. Okay, I need to know. Did the spot on your finger actually work?
Okay, I have not looked at the scientific evidence at all behind it, but just anecdotally, yes.
Amazing. He's like acupressure.
Yeah, it's like acupuncture, acupressure. Yeah. I know that there has been a lot that have come out in the literature with how there's these different, the meridian lines in traditional Chinese medicine have these connections to your fascia, and the fascia is connects your organs and different body parts together. So there is something to it. And I think that more science can potentially elucidate that in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, I think so too. And in the meantime, it's a can't hurt, might help thing. But
exactly. Can't hurt, might help.
Yeah. And so many of us in integrated medicine had a mom who was like shoving echinacea in our mouth when we were sick.
Yep, same. Yep.
Okay, so you have a really holistic approach and a really wide lens when you're looking for the root cause of an issue. And so you're actually the perfect person to talk to about this.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
We have so many people, I can't even tell you how many women, especially postpartum or in a hormonal transition of life, feel like they're losing their hair and they don't know why. They're either like, it's hormones or it's stress. But you have a couple categories that you actually look at when someone comes in with hair thinning or hair loss and or hair shedding. And I'm wondering what those are, because it's more than just those two things.
Yes. So yeah, when somebody comes in with hair thinning, there potentially are a lot of factors at play. The two most common forms of hair loss that we see, one is called androgenetic alopecia. That's the formal term for male pattern or female pattern hair loss, where it's mostly thinning at the top of the scalp. And there's a huge genetic component to that. But of course, there's a lot of factors in our environment that can bring that out. And then the other most common form of hair loss is telogen effluvium, which is diffuse hair shedding that occurs after some type of stressor. It could be a bunch of different stressors. It could be a physical stressor, like an illness that you had, or it could be a mental stressor, like a really bad breakup. It could be low deficiencies in certain nutrients, or like you had rapid weight loss. And it's interesting, when you are exposed to that stressor, it sends a signal to your hair follicles to just go into the resting phase. And that resting phase lasts about 3 to 4 months. And after the resting phase, the hair automatically goes into the shedding phase. So with telogen effluvium, I always ask patients, okay, I ask them about what could have been going on in their lives 3 to 5 months prior to them noticing their hair loss, to see if we can point a trigger. And interestingly, there's a lot of overlap with androgenetic alopecia and telogen effluvium. A different stressor or trigger can bring out an underlying predisposition for androgenetic alopecia. And oftentimes with hair loss, there's multiple things happening at the same time. Because there's so many things that can trigger hair loss or set people up for hair loss, being on certain medications, being low in certain nutrients, having an illness, moving into a different environment. Yeah, trying to go through all of those factors.
Wow. Okay. So is there a natural regrowth cycle that happens? I'm wondering if patients come in at that 5 or 6 month mark, because they're like, oh my gosh, I've been losing my hair for a month. If they just waited till the 9 months, does it typically start to regrow?
It often can. Yes. Yeah. If the trigger was like a one-time instance, like if it was just a bad case of COVID or something and everything else was perfect in the body, like thyroid's good, iron levels are good, vitamin D levels are good, stress is good. If it was just a random fluke in their life, then hair can grow back, in 6 months to a year. But oftentimes there's could be these other underlying things going on that makes them more susceptible to that hair loss incidence in the first place. And then the hair loss can continue from that, like if those other underlying things aren't addressed too. Because not everyone with COVID is going to lose their hair, or not everyone who goes through surgery is going to lose their hair. But people who have these other deficiencies in their life or other stressors in their life are more likely to continue having hair loss if those aren't addressed either.
Okay. Where the root cause workup comes in, even deeper. So it's been stressed, but let's look at the vulnerability. So let's say you're just talking to practitioners in the audience who are thinking, what labs would I run? A couple things, thyroid, iron. What's the list that they should have on their differential for a patient who comes in with hair loss?
Depending on the history, when it comes to uncovering what could be setting off the telogen effluvium. So when it comes to nutrient deficiencies, low iron is huge. So probably one of the most common things that we see. And when you check an iron panel, I just also make sure you are looking at ferritin. And because even the normal range for ferritin, you want it to be above, I would say ferritin above 50. I know we don't like high ferritin either because ferritin can be a sign of underlying inflammation too. But I think the normal range in labs is 30 or less, somewhere around there, 20 or less. I would say the goal is to be at least 50. And then the other thing, vitamin D too, D as well. So that one, the range 30 or higher is considered sufficient. I try to aim for at least 40, and everyone's different. Some people like shoot for 60. I've seen so much vitamin D deficiency that I'm like, if you're at 40, that's great. But yeah, some people like to shoot for higher. And then those are the top ones. I think it's also worth checking B12 and zinc. Zinc can be a little bit tricky because I think it can vary depending on time of day too. But yeah, so you have to take the results with a grain of salt. But those are some things to look at. I don't see as many abnormalities with those. So yes. And then you mentioned thyroid. Thyroid is huge. I do TSH, but I also like to check free T3, free T4. I do like to screen for antibodies. I do find not too infrequently that all the thyroid markers are normal, except the antibodies can be positive. And so it tells me their body is inflamed and that could be also playing a role with the hair loss too. And then depending on other presentations, so if they're a young woman and they're really looking bald on the top of their scalp, that's when I will really check hormones because that's not normal. Yes, thinning on the scalp can happen and there could be a genetic component to it, but when it's pretty noticeable and if it's alongside other symptoms like facial hair or acne, if we're concerned about PCOS, if there's irregular periods, I will check hormones like DHEAS, and then I'll check testosterone levels, like free and total testosterone. But yeah, hormones are tough because oftentimes they are normal, but your body can have slight changes in hormones and it can have a huge impact, phenotypically or physically, but the labs would be normal. So that's why it's like, I want to see if the presentation's really notable, that's when I'll check hormones. And then also depending on other symptoms, I will screen for lupus, like doing an ANA if they have other potential symptoms that could be supportive of lupus or other autoimmune presentation. So those are those would be the main labs that I check.
That's a good list. And I think people will be surprised to hear some of that, especially things like zinc may not even run for them before they've been to a practitioner about this issue.
Yeah. So something to think about, especially if the other tests are normal.
Yeah. And is that because zinc's involved in I know it's involved in wound healing and skin health and immune health.
Yeah, but it's active. It's an active mineral in the hair follicle too. So it plays an important role there.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I barely learned that in derm residency. So yeah.
Fascinating. Okay. This is a good list. So I'm guessing people have to be asking you, let's say they did have a nutrient deficiency. They're correcting it. Maybe it's corrected. How long do they have to wait until they start to see a difference? Do you hear this a lot?
Oh, yeah. I would say a minimum of 3 months.
It makes sense with what you said about the cycle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, I usually, that would be like my earliest follow-up for patients.
And so let's say someone's dealing with hair loss and they're thinking, I'll just go get these labs at LabCorp Direct and I won't go to a dermatologist or a doctor. Is there a benefit in seeing someone who is an expert to maybe help you figure out the type of hair loss, but also to maybe rule out some other disorders that could be contributing?
Yeah, exactly. So there's multiple reasons. One is you could have completely normal lab tests and still have shedding for whatever reason. But you're right, there could be other forms of hair loss that you may want to get checked, especially early, especially if it's what's called scarring alopecia or the scarring types of hair loss. Thankfully, those are uncommon, but those you want to really get ahead of with treating. Otherwise, you're going to get permanent hair loss with that. And those are things like frontal fibrosing alopecia, where your frontal hairline is really going, is receding, which we think of with male pattern baldness. And that can happen in some forms of female pattern hair loss, but you get this shiny scalp that's receding back. There's something called CCCA, cicatricial alopecia. And this is more common in African-American women. And we see a lot of hair loss in African-American women. So this is something I always want to make sure people, we rule out. And I also like to screen lupus. Lupus is something I see also more often in my African-American patient population. So that's another reason to see dermatologists too, is to make sure that there are not these other forms of hair loss. But yeah, usually with the CCCA, it's like starting in the crown and you get a spreading of this scarring alopecia. It could be other patches around it too. There's also, so those are the more common scarring alopecias. There's another one called lichen planopilaris, where you get patchy hair loss throughout the scalp. It can look like alopecia areata, which I think a lot of people are familiar with, where you also get round patches of hair loss. That one actually has a pretty good prognosis. That one, that's an autoimmune form of hair loss, but hair oftentimes regrows, thankfully, with that. It's not scarring. We do steroid injections locally on the scalp for that. Same with these other forms of scarring alopecia and certain oral anti-inflammatory medications too. So it's good to have a visual inspection of your scalp to catch those other conditions.
Yeah, that's a powerful case for just seeing an expert once. Just run it by.
Just once, yeah.
And just make sure you get the right diagnosis and that you're on the right path. And an expert has ruled out things that aren't going to be helped. Maybe by nutrient or lifestyle factors. I love that. I'm so curious if there are things that you see people doing that contribute to either hair breaking, hair thinning, that are just like you wish you could just have a megaphone and tell the world, like, stop using this type of brush or stop washing your hair every day. Do you have tips and tricks?
Oh my gosh, yes. One of my biggest ones, it's about hair washing, actually. So one of the things that happens when people start seeing hair shedding, hair loss, they notice a lot of it when they're taking a shower and it freaks them out. So they stop washing their hair as often and they just become more depressed, because when you're not washing your hair as often, when it comes time to showering, you'll see like all that hair that's falling out is collecting. So you're just going to see even more hair loss on your hands. And the thing is, if you are spreading out your hair washes more so while you're dealing with hair loss, you can actually make your hair loss worse. And one of the reasons is because when you're washing your hair less frequently, you're letting oil build up on your scalp, which is okay to a certain degree. But when you have too much of a buildup, that can actually cause local inflammation on your scalp, because the microbiome on our scalp, we have a lot of yeast that lives on our scalp. It lives in harmony with the other microorganisms. But when you create a lot of oil, and I also think that different oil can come from, like, certain lifestyle can contribute to more, quote, inflammatory oil on your scalp, but that's like a whole discussion and that's more theoretical. But anyways, more oil on your scalp usually equals more inflammation potentially, because that's more food for the yeast to feed on. And when you have more inflammation, that makes the hair follicles more vulnerable and more likely to cause the hair to fall out. And so that's the number one thing I wish I could tell patients. If you're noticing hair loss, please don't wash your hair less often. At least continue your same pattern of hair washing. You might actually have to wash your hair more, because one of the things that triggers or that contributes to perpetual hair loss, like, there could be an outside trigger, but something that can continually perpetuate it is dandruff, which is the yeast feeding on the oil in your scalp, and the flaking is the byproduct of the yeast. So dandruff, seborrheic dermatitis is the medical term for it, but having that inflammation on your scalp is going to continue to cause your hair to fall out more. And so actually, if you're dealing with hair loss, our favorite shampoos are anti-dandruff shampoos. Nizoral is our favorite, which is ketoconazole. There's a prescription form that's 2%, over-the-counter is 1%, but ketoconazole is an anti-yeast medication. Interestingly, it also has hormonal activity, like it works on certain hormone receptors on the scalp, so it can help with androgenetic alopecia, which is a nice side effect of it. Wow. So we love that. Yeah. Zinc shampoos, topical zinc is also helpful for the scalp. So that when it comes to hair loss, so you're killing two birds, like if you're dealing with dandruff too. So that's something I definitely recommend.
Can people use that long term, or is there any issue with using zinc shampoo or ketoconazole shampoo just all the time?
Yeah, I think zinc is fine. Now, with ketoconazole, there's issues with oral ketoconazole pills. We don't really prescribe that as much these days as we did even when I was like in residency. We did more when I was in residency like 15 years ago. But so as theoretically, systemic absorption is not ideal for chronic ketoconazole shampoo use. But really, what I tell patients is once your hair is where it's at, if you're happy for maintenance, I would use ketoconazole shampoo once a week or a couple times a month. And that's fine.
So you mentioned a couple of medications to be on the lookout for that actually could contribute to hair loss. And I'm what a few of those are. And people might be looking in their medicine cabinets right now wondering.
Yeah. Okay. I would say the biggest one most recently are the GLP-1 meds. And there could be a few reasons of why we see hair loss with GLP-1. I think the biggest thing we think about first is that drastic weight loss, especially I think more so a couple of years ago when people were just jumping right to the high dose of it and they would have drastic weight loss. And so your body is not used to almost that shock to the system. And that can set off telogen effluvium. But it's interesting. We have also, I think there's also something in the medicine itself that can set off hair loss in people too, even without the drastic weight loss shift. So that's something to think about. Obviously, we don't see it in everyone. I think we could see it in people who are predisposed to hair loss or people who aren't getting adequate nutrition while they're on Ozempic or whatever, any variation of that medicine. And so, yeah, that's a huge one. Another one that I also think is relevant to women of childbearing age is birth control pills. And I feel like birth control pills are can be a controversial topic because it's been such a huge, amazing invention and contribution to the medical world for our society. So amazing in that aspect. But there are issues that we do see, like side effect wise, especially for people who have been on it for years or decades. And we have studies to show that it can affect absorption of certain micronutrients. And also just going on birth control, you are shifting your hormones, not enough where you're going to see abnormalities on blood tests, but you're shifting your hormones. That's going to send signals to your scalp. Not everyone, of course, but some people, that there's something different going on in your body. Going off birth control can also do that too. So that's something that I also think about. And then another medicine that's, we see this kind of often in people who take this medicine. It's not a common medicine in younger people, but it's a beta blocker medicine. So things like metoprolol, people who have heart issues or blood pressure issues, that one we do see can trigger hair loss. Statin medicines as well, not as often as beta blockers, but we do see that. Sometimes SSRIs, it can. Not as much as the other ones that I mentioned. But yeah, those are top of mind, what I think about.
Comprehensive list.
Yeah. And honestly, I think anything's possible with any medicine, like anything that just changes your body in a different way. But in terms of where we traditionally see hair loss, those are the ones.
And it's good to know. So I'm wondering, someone might be thinking, oh my gosh, I started a statin. It totally changed my life. I'm better with my cholesterol. Or I'm taking an SSRI and I finally feel better. Do I have to go off it or stop it to stop the hair loss? And I'm guessing that sometimes they can actually just switch to a different form of the medication and that might help.
Yes. Yeah. More often than not, I also first try to look at the big picture. What's ultimately most important for this person's health, like preventing a heart attack or losing hair? Preventing a heart attack is probably more important. Maintaining their mood or minimizing depression. But yes, for sure, I will oftentimes talk to their prescribing physician and have a conversation. Are there other options potentially if the hair loss is really that debilitating for the patient? It's a conversation I have with each patient to just weigh the pros and cons, because some people, I think it is important for them to stay on their medication. I love that you brought up switching medications. I think that people don't need to lose hope. It's always worth exploring other options.
And there's so many different forms of most medications now.
Yes.
Yeah. And we've all had those patients who, for one reason or another, genetics, whatever, they respond well to one type of SSRI or birth control and really poorly to another one that may even be considered in the same category. You work some experimentation. Now, you mentioned, and I think this is so important, so I'm going to bring us back to this. Sometimes there can be a trigger for hair loss, whether it's starting a new medication or stressor or being sick, but that sometimes if you're vulnerable because you've got deficiencies or something else going on with your hair or scalp, then that can contribute to that stressor becoming a hair loss inciting incident. And one of the things I love that I heard you speak about on one of your YouTube videos was that not eating enough protein can be one of those things. And then you mentioned inflammation and the scalp. Like, can we talk about diet and style and the role that plays here, even maybe in just setting someone up to be a little bit more vulnerable?
For sure. Yes. Protein is a huge part. I think that people who, I don't want to demonize any diets at all, but like people are on vegetarian or vegan diets where, of course, there are forms of protein that you can get, but you have to work a little bit harder to make sure that you're getting adequate protein levels. We do see potentially more issues with that. I personally have struggled with hair loss, which is one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about it. It runs very strongly in my family. My dad was bald at 19. So androgenetic alopecia is very significant for me. And then like came out for me when I was in residency. I was had been living like a vegetarian diet lifestyle for 10 years prior to residency. And then, of course, like just crazy stress and sleepless nights, 30-hour shifts, just horrible things that are very anti-doctor, anti-healthcare-like. Such an ironic thing that we go through as doctors. But anyway, so protein is a big deal. Protein really gives you the building blocks for hair. A lot of the amino acids play a really big role in sending signals as well as being building blocks for hair growth. And the other dietary thing is low calorie, like calorie restriction diets too. So where you are not getting adequate nutrition in general, getting weight loss, losing a lot of weight with that. There's not like one specific thing. Going gluten-free can help some people. Like gluten-free diets has been associated with improvement in alopecia areata, which is interesting. Not in everyone, but there was a small study that did show that it can help. And like in some people who are dealing with Hashimoto's, and if that's related to hair loss, going gluten-free, maybe dairy-free can be helpful for that. We're not like, you have to stop these specific foods, or there's no clear guideline with that, with hair loss, but we just know that protein and low calorie restriction or low calorie diets play a role. People who would get bariatric surgery. And so literally removing part of your intestine or stomach area where you're not absorbing as those fat soluble vitamins as well. So like vitamin D can play a role, potentially low iron. There was like this like weird trend going on in social media about like how drinking matcha can cause hair loss. And the thought is that it could potentially affect, and I think there was a small study, because I looked into this, because I was like, that is interesting. So it can potentially affect, like the green tea can affect like absorption of iron. Have you seen that?
I am remembering, this was like 6 months ago.
Yeah, but it is something, it's something to think about since so many people drink matcha. But it also reminds me of just this whole category of caffeine consumption, which I think, okay to drink a cup of coffee, but so many people are drinking a lot of caffeine, more than a couple cups of coffee a day. And I think that can create almost like this artificial stress in your body where, it can, if you're prone to it, it can potentially affect hair loss. There's another thing that's not diet related, but also sleep too. There are studies to show that poor sleep and a disruption in your circadian rhythm can affect or can bring out androgenetic alopecia too.
Okay. You weren't kidding when you say you take a whole person approach.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot to go over.
It's so helpful. I do think so many people think they're getting enough protein. And I'm curious the tips that you give people or how you help them know if they're getting enough, or because I hear people say, I put milk in my cereal in the morning and then I have peanut butter and jelly, so I'm good. And I think it's hard to know how much you should be getting and how to add it in, particularly if you're someone who just, I think of your average teenager, right? They run out school in the morning, they probably skip lunch, they eat candy bar. It's just, so how do you talk to people about how much protein they should be getting and maybe some easy ways to get some in if it's hard for them?
Yeah, so I know I try to... Not that I'm like a super lenient doctor, but I try to be realistic with patients because you want there to be compliance. You don't want to overwhelm them because there's so much they probably should do. And it's okay, in order for them to get better, I don't want to dissuade them from this whole long list of things, but I try to keep it simple. I say try to aim for 20 to 30 grams a meal if you can, at least. And if it's hard, making a smoothie and just literally adding your protein powder of choice to that, or just making sure if you eat meat that there's like one portion of meat with your meals, or eggs, beans. I love beans. I think beans are underrated. Just because I just love them for their fiber too and their other nutrients. But yeah. So I don't really go too in depth. That's pretty much the extent of what I talk about.
I think that's smart, and that's a lot. For some people to move to 20 to 30 grams a meal is a big jump for them. So
yeah,
that's a good number to shoot for. If you're an adult, easy thing to remember and try. This is brilliant. I want to close this out by talking about our postpartum folks, because these mm-hmm. folks are just, I feel like they are the ones noticing the hair loss. It can be so disconcerting, especially at that time of life. And hearing that it's normal can be a comfort. What conversations do you have with people who come in around this time of life?
Oh my gosh, postpartum. So there's so many reasons why people lose their hair in the postpartum phase. So no one should feel bad if it's happening. I know you're probably already overwhelmed with everything else going on in life, but when you give birth, first of all, that can be a traumatic experience in and of itself, right? The insane pain, like if you don't get an epidural, like the pain that you get, or if you get a C-section, surgery is a huge trigger for hair loss, right? So there's that, the whole delivery experience. But also when you give birth, there's a plummet in your hormones. You have this drastic drop. And that is huge when it comes to setting off this hair loss cascade and triggering telogen effluvium. And then you get all these sleepless nights. So, I mentioned bad, your poor sleep affects hair loss. You're stressed potentially. So there's a lot of factors at play. So I just really encourage moms to have grace. I have a 3.5 month old and I am starting to notice some shedding. So I can relate, and I have experienced it with my first. I have a 2.5 year old, and that one, that experience was really bad, because the other thing that happened was I had postpartum hemorrhage with him. So my iron, low blood, low iron. So that contributed a huge deal to my postpartum hair loss. So I'm like, okay, this time I'm going to be more prepared. So I actually had a lot of hemorrhage too with this one. I actually had way more with this delivery, to the point where I had to get a blood transfusion, which is wild to me, because I thought I would always be invincible to that. I've had to write for blood transfusions for patients when I was doing my internal medicine residency, and I never thought I would need it, but I had to get 3 units of blood. I lost 2.5 liters of blood, which is crazy. We have 5 liters of blood in our body. So the fact that I lost half my blood is insane. So I'm bracing myself. There are things you can do. Now, if you're breastfeeding, your options are a little bit more limited, unfortunately, but there are still things you can do. There are supplements out there. Okay, there's topical, and then there's oral things to do. There's a supplement that I do really like that I think is pretty comprehensive, hydrolyzed marine collagen, which has been shown in studies to increase hair density, hair thickness. Topically, so we love topical minoxidil in general for hair loss. That's the FDA approved over-the-counter treatment. It works. Like, people don't like it because it takes forever to work. Sometimes you get hair shedding before hair regrowth. So a lot of people are discouraged by it and they don't want to use it. You have, like I tell people, you have to stick to it for 6 months. Now, when it comes to breastfeeding though, it's a little bit of a gray area. The safe recommendation is to not use it. The likelihood that it's going to be systemically absorbed and be an issue is pretty low. So just take that as you will. Some derms are fine with people using it while breastfeeding, but we don't have enough guidelines to say it's safe. So I'm just going to say that. But there are other topical serums, other topical treatments that can be helpful. There are like ingredients like caffeine. There are compelling studies to show that caffeine is helpful at improving circulation in the scalp. There are different peptides in topical products that can trigger the follicle to activate more and grow more hair, or peptides that can reduce inflammation on the scalp. I think these aren't going to be as strong as minoxidil, but these are great while you're breastfeeding. I'm also a huge fan of red light therapy, like the helmets and the caps. I've seen it work. The data is also more compelling for red light for hair loss than it is for the red light masks for your face.
Wow.
And I love red light for your face too. I think we could get some better data out there, but there is good data for red light therapy for your scalp when it comes to reducing inflammation, improving blood flow. And then speaking of blood flow, scalp massaging or things that you could do to just stimulate the scalp. There's scalp massager tools out there that you can use. A few minutes a day can make a really big difference. Yeah. So that's what I recommend. If you're not breastfeeding, I would go all out with the topical Rogaine. I do a prescription form. I use a compounding pharmacy where I do an even stronger form of minoxidil combined with tretinoin, which is Retin-A, that helps the minoxidil penetrate better into the scalp. So I do that. And then I also, oral minoxidil works great too. Oral spironolactone can be helpful as well. Yeah.
You have a whole kit.
There's stuff. And then for really bad cases, if you're not a candidate for oral medicine, there's also microneedling with PRP injections. PRP has decent outcome. So there are derms who deeply specialize in hair loss and only treat hair loss. And they'll have special machines in their office, like lasers and ultrasound devices that can also help promote hair growth too.
This is so good to know. I think I only knew about half of those.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Like I said, I feel like I also have geeked out on this stuff because I've personally dealt with hair loss too. And yeah.
Oh, I love that episode with Dr. Mavina. Now, we've recorded two with her. This one was on hair health. The next one is on skin aging and everything that we can do to figure out why it's happening, slow it down, and help our skin be the healthiest it can be. I highly encourage you to go check that episode out. As always, please subscribe, leave a review, let us know what you thought of this episode. We read every single review on Spotify. We'll catch you guys next week on the Root Cause Medicine Podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. We're so glad you're here. Before you go, we'd love your help spreading this message of whole person care. Our goal is to bring this education to more practitioners for free, and you can make a huge difference. If you liked today's episode, leave us a 5-star review. We read every single one. Drop a comment and let us know what resonated with you, or share this episode with a friend or colleague who might enjoy it. One important note, the views expressed on this podcast are those of the hosts and the guests, and they don't necessarily reflect the views of Fullscript or any affiliated organizations. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only, and it's not intended to be medical advice. For your safety, always check with your healthcare provider before making any changes to your healthcare routine. We'll catch you next time on the Root Cause Medicine Podcast.